From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're going to miss you in this administration. You've been a stalwart defender of freedom and peace. You've been strong in your advocacy for human rights and human dignity. You've done everything that can be expected for an ambassador.
Facing stiff opposition in the new Democratic-controlled Senate, President Bush accepts the resignation of U.N. Ambassador John Bolton. We'll speak with U.N. expert Phyllis Bennis. Bolton's the second high-profile member of Bush's team to announce his departure since the midterm elections. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld resigned last month. Bush's nominee to replace him, Robert Gates, is facing his confirmation hearings today. We'll speak with two former CIA analysts who work with Gates at the agency. And Cuba is coming off a week-long celebration of the 80th birthday of President Fidel Castro, which he himself was too ill to attend. We'll talk with award-winning filmmaker John Alpert, who did attend, about his many encounters with Castro over the last three decades. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. John Bolton's resigned as ambassador to the UN, ending a controversial 16-month term. In August 2005, Bolton was given temporary recess appointment after he failed to be confirmed by the Senate. Last month, President Bush renominated Bolton, but a number of Democratic and Republican senators announced they would not back his confirmation. President Bush met with Bolton on Monday.
I received the resignation of Ambassador John Bolton. I accept it. I'm not happy about it. I think he deserved to be confirmed. And the reason why I think he deserved to be confirmed is because I know he did a fabulous job for the country.
One top contender to replace Bolton is reported to be Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador in Iraq. Since the November election, three of the most prominent hawks in the Bush administration have resigned: John Bolton, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and Stephen Cambone, the Pentagon's top intelligence official. On Capitol Hill, confirmation hearings begin today for former CIA Director Robert Gates, the man tapped by Bush to succeed Rumsfeld. In Iraq, a series of shootings and bombings have left at least 30 people dead in Baghdad. A triple car bombing near a fuel station killed 15 people. Another 15 died when gunmen attacked a bus carrying employees of the Shia Endowment, a body that oversees religious sites and mosques. The U.S. death toll in the war has topped 2,900. At least 13 U.S. soldiers have died since Friday, including four Marines in a helicopter crash in Anbar province. The military claims the helicopter experienced mechanical problems and was not hit by gunfire. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan's warning the situation in Iraq is now much worse than a civil war.
Given the level of the violence, the level of killing and bitterness, and the way the forces are arrayed against each other. Look at a few years ago when we had the strife in Lebanon and other places. We call that a civil war. This is much worse.
During an interview on the BBC, Annan said he also understood why some Iraqis regret the fall of Saddam Hussein. On Monday at the White House, President Bush met with one of Iraq's most powerful Shia leaders, Abdulaziz al-Hakim.
I appreciate so very much His Eminence's commitment to a unity government. I assured him the United States supports his work and the work of the Prime Minister to unify the country. Part of unifying Iraq is for the elected leaders and society leaders to reject the extremists that are trying to stop the advance of this young democracy.
Hakim is the leader of the pro-Iranian Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution and the head of the Badr Brigade, a Shia militia accused of operating death squads. He rejected calls for an international conference to deal with the Iraq crisis.
We believe that the Iraqi issue should be solved by the Iraqis with the help of friends everywhere. But we reject any attempts to have a regional or international role in solving the Iraqi issue. We cannot bypass the political process. Iraq should be in a position to solve Iraqi problems.
Hakim also called on the United States to crack down harder on Sunni insurgents. The Shia cleric said, quote, "Eliminating the danger of civil war in Iraq could only be achieved through directing decisive strikes against Ba'athist terrorists in Iraq." The number of private contractors in Iraq has now reached about 100,000, the most ever used in a U.S. military operation. Halliburton's subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root is one of the largest contractors in Iraq. It has more than 50,000 employees and subcontractors working between Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kuwait. Blackwater USA has more than 1,000 employees in Iraq. DynCorp has about 1,500 employees there. The Supreme Court heard arguments Monday in a pair of cases that could determine whether local governments can take measures to promote racially desegregated schools. Parents of white students in Seattle and Louisville sued their local school districts to challenge policies that considered race as a factor in determining what schools students attend. The New York Times reports after Monday's oral arguments, it appears the court will rule on the side of the white parents. Civil rights groups have said such a ruling would undermine the promise of Brown versus Board of Education, the landmark 1954 decision that outlawed separate systems of education for black and white school children. In Lebanon, a funeral is taking place today for Ahmed Ali Mahmoud, the Shia man killed Sunday after he took part in an anti-government rally organized by Hezbollah. He was shot as he walked through a Sunni neighborhood of Beirut. According to the Independent newspaper of London, some in Lebanon feel Ahmed Mahmoud might have been the first victim of the next Lebanese civil war. Relatives of Mahmoud have accused the Sunni Future Movement of carrying out the killing. That group is led by Saad Hariri, the son of Lebanon's Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, who was assassinated last year. Meanwhile, anti-government protests in Beirut have entered their fifth day. Amr Moussa, the Secretary General of the Arab League, has been in Beirut meeting with government officials and the protest leaders.
I'm worried about the current situation in Lebanon. I shouldn't worry about the future if we all work to save the situation today. I'm sure that the Lebanese people, with their industrious richness, can always surmount any of those obstacles, provided that we all help them and they decide to help themselves, that Lebanon should not be divided.
In Mexico, police have arrested a leader of the Popular Assembly of the Oaxacan People, which has led the popular uprising in the southern state of Oaxaca. Flavia Sosa was detained in Mexico City Monday after he gave a press conference announcing APO planned to hold negotiations with the government of Felipe Calderon. The police accused Sosa of being involved in kidnapping, violent robbery and arson, charges he denies. In other news from Oaxaca, a judge has released two local officials who were jailed in connection with the murder of indie media journalist Brad Will. Will was shot dead in October as he filmed paramilitary forces shooting at protesters in Oaxaca. The men have acknowledged shooting at the crowd, but state prosecutors claim they couldn't have fired the shots that killed Will. The Committee to Protect Journalists criticized the release of the men and called on Mexican federal authorities to take over the investigation into the killing. The U.S. State Department has rejected a call for diplomatic talks with Cuba. Cuba's acting president, Raul Castro, called for negotiations with the United States to resolve its long-standing isolation of the Cuban government.
We are convinced the exit to the conflicts that affect humanity is not war, but in political solutions. We take this opportunity to once again state we are willing to resolve at the negotiating table the long-standing dispute between the United States and Cuba, as long as they accept, as we have said, our condition as a country that does not tolerate shadows on its independence.
State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick responded Monday.
I don't see how that really furthers the cause of democracy in that country, where you have dialogue with a dictator in waiting who wants to continue the form of governance that has really kept down the Cuban people for all these decades.
We'll be speaking with award-winning filmmaker John Alpert just back from Havana later in the program. In Fiji, the military has seized power in the country's fourth coup in the past 20 years. The country's prime minister has been placed under house arrest, and Fiji's military commander has announced he has taken over. In the Philippines, a U.S. Marine has been sentenced to 40 years in prison for raping a 23-year-old Filipina woman at a Navy base in Manila last year. The Marine, Lance Corporal Daniel Smith, plans to appeal the ruling. Three other Marines were acquitted in the case. This is Renato Reyes, who led protests outside the courtroom.
The verdict, while we are happy with the conviction of at least one U.S. Marine, it goes to show the weaknesses, the difficulties in prosecuting any American soldier under the current visiting forces agreement. It has become difficult to gain custody of the suspects. It has become difficult to really investigate the incident.
The case has generated a lot of attention in the Philippines, where many residents oppose the U.S. military presence there. In Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair is urging lawmakers to back his plan to rebuild the country's nuclear arms program by designing a fleet of new submarines armed with nuclear warheads. On Monday, Blair insisted Britain cannot get rid of its nuclear weapons program.
That it is noteworthy that no present nuclear power is or is even considering divesting itself of its nuclear capability unilaterally, and that in these circumstances, it would be unwise and dangerous for Britain, alone of any of the nuclear powers, to give up its independent nuclear deterrent.
In other news, NASA has announced plans to build the first permanent base on the moon. NASA gave no cost estimate for the program, but said construction will begin in the year 2020. In Denmark, three journalists have been acquitted on charges of endangering national security. They were arrested after they published a series of articles based on classified Danish intelligence reports that concluded Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. And Bolivian President Evo Morales has publicly praised Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's re-election.
We're very happy about Chavez's victory, just like Correa's victory, just like Nicaragua's victory. The Latin American democracies are strengthening. We welcome whoever wins through the vote of the people. It's a way to deepen democracy.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations Ambassador John Bolton announced Monday he would step down from his post when his temporary appointment expires in January. Bolton is an outspoken critic of the United Nations. He was appointed by President Bush last August when Congress was in recess. This was done after Senate Democrats had blocked a floor vote on his nomination. The recess appointment allowed Bolton to bypass Senate confirmation and hold the UN job until a new congressional term began. In November, Bush nominated Bolton again and planned to push for confirmation before his term expired. But as both Democrat and Republican senators announced they would not support him, it became clear Bolton's chances for confirmation were slim. Bush accepted Bolton's resignation yesterday in the Oval Office.
I received the resignation of Ambassador John Bolton. I accept it. I'm not happy about it. I think he deserved to be confirmed. And the reason why I think he deserved to be confirmed is because I know he did a fabulous job for the country. And I want to thank you and Gretchen for serving in a very important position and doing so in a way that a lot of Americans really appreciate, John. We're going to miss you in this administration. You've been a stalwart defender of freedom and peace. You've been strong in your advocacy for human rights and human dignity. You've done everything that can be expected for an ambassador. And I accept your letter, and I wish you and Gretchen all the very best.
Many thanks for your service.
John Bolton was a controversial choice for U.N. ambassador. 64 former American ambassadors recently signed a letter opposing him. Many felt his hardline conservative ideology and his confrontational approach was at odds with the U.N.'s multilateral goals. This is John Bolton speaking at a conference in New York in 1994, widely cited as evidence of his incompatibility with the U.N. job.
If you think that there is any possibility in this country that a 51,000-person bureaucracy is going to be supported by most Americans, you better think again. The Secretariat building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. The United Nations is one of the most inefficient intergovernmental organizations going. UNESCO is even worse. And others go downhill from there. The fact of the matter is that the international system that has grown up, and again, I leave out the World Bank and the IMF because I do think they're in a separate category, has been put into a position of hiring ineffective people who do ineffective things that have no real world impact. And we pay 25% of the budget.
John Bolton speaking in 1994. Phyllis Bennis was there at that event and joins us now from Washington, D.C., a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, specializing in Middle East and United Nations issues, author of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the U.N. Defy U.S. Power. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Good morning, Amy. Good to be with you.
Were you surprised by the resignation?
I was pleased by the resignation. I think it was probably inevitable after the elections, where the overall Bush policy was repudiated so powerfully in those elections. John Bolton, President Bush said something just now that was quite right. John Bolton was a good representative of the Bush administration policy. He Bush made a decision to send a bully to carry out a policy of bullying the United Nations. And Bolton did a very good job of that. The real question now is, the bully is gone. Is there a chance that the policy that gave rise to such bullying, is that going to change as well? That's what we don't know yet.
Can you talk about the people who are possibly going to succeed him?
Well, the most the top of the list that we're seeing right now is someone like Zalmay Khalilzad, who's currently the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Also known as a conservative hardliner, a very aggressive style of diplomacy, not seen as abrupt and dismissive and aggressive in the form of John Bolton, perhaps a, quote, better diplomat in that sense, but certainly reflecting the same bullying politics. The only one on the list that I've seen that is slightly different, that reflects the more realistic positions within the administration, is Nick Burns, who has a long history both in the Clinton administration and throughout the Bush administration. He's one of Condoleezza Rice's top deputies. And his style is much more traditional diplomacy, very glad-handing, very friendly. He would presumably make it more difficult at the United Nations for other countries to mobilize strong opposition. This morning's New York Times quotes the current ambassador to Tanzania at the United Nations, who is on the Security Council this year with John Bolton, who said that that Bolton had deepened the divisions between the developing world and the great powers, and said that he would be remembered for as the person who could have done it differently in order to minimize the negative perceptions of the positions of the United States. Of course, the issue becomes now, if the Bush administration decides to send a, quote, good diplomat, somebody who will be friendly at the UN, who will be more collaborative in the Security Council, respectful in the General Assembly, it will make it more difficult for government representatives there to mobilize as powerfully as they did against John Bolton. But the real question is, what policy will that new ambassador reflect? And so far, we've seen absolutely no indication from President Bush or anyone else in his administration that there is any intention of taking the United Nations more seriously, respecting the independence of the institution, rather than treating it with the same disdain that we just heard from John Bolton in that same year in the debate in Washington, where he was debating with me and the late Erskine Childers. He actually said, there is no United Nations. There's a group of countries that do something once in a while when the United States tells them to. That was always John Bolton's view of the United Nations. I think that is George Bush's view of the United Nations. And the real question is that still their view?
Phyllis, I'm looking at a piece by Justin Rood, who says, the man with the iron mustache is leaving the international arena, but not before attempting a thoroughly embarrassing and wholly unsympathetic maneuver. Less than 2 weeks before the White House announced his resignation, Ambassador John Bolton's UN mission blocked an effort to celebrate the end of slavery in our hemisphere.
This is only one of a number of incidents like this where it was not even a matter of U.S. policy, whether this was even dictated by the White House or the State Department, we don't even know, or whether this was just John Bolton on his own, the rogue ambassador representing the large rogue state, saying, this isn't relevant to me, I'm not going to let anyone else do it. And without any concept of what that means for how Americans, as well as U.S. policy, is viewed around the world. The opposition to John Bolton at the United Nations is really hard to overstate. It was enough that the staff of the UN was given orders yesterday when the announcement came about his resignation that no one was to comment, that the only answer, if anyone on the staff was asked their opinion, the only answer was to be no comment.
Then Ian Williams writes in The Nation's, from the White House point of view, Bolton's appointment appeased the know-nothing foreign policy crowd while rewarding his long-standing loyalty to the Bush dynasty. That loyalty had been shown most memorably in 2000 when the man who spent the past year preaching democracy to members of the United Nations strode into a library polling place in Florida yelling, "I'm with the Bush-Cheney team, and I'm here to stop the count."
That's, again, a very good example of what John Bolton represented. He had no sense of any other feature than power as the basis of what he did as a diplomat, what he did in representing the Bush administration. This was a man, when he was the Undersecretary of State for Disarmament Affairs under Colin Powell, he was there at the moment that the Israeli military used a set of U.S. weapons to assassinate a Hamas leader in Gaza. This was in 2002, when 15 people, civilians, in the same apartment building, inevitably, because it was a rocket strike at 3 o'clock in the morning, 9 of them were children, were killed in that rocket strike, and State Department officials prepared a memo for Colin Powell saying that this might be a violation of U.S. law, not international law, but the Arms Export Control Act that prohibits the use of U.S.-provided weapons in that way. Bolton saw that memo, said, "Oh, this is rubbish," and ordered his staff to write a memo saying, "No harm, no foul, there was no problem." The two memos were supposed to be sent together to Colin Powell, but it was reported in U.S. News and World Report at the time that John Bolton got a hold of the earlier memo, pulled it, so to make sure that his own boss was denied access to the material that had been prepared by his own staff because Bolton didn't happen to like it. So it's that kind of arrogance and that kind of certitude about his own view of unilateralism, militarism, the sacred support of the United States for Israel. All of these things were very much at the center of why he was appointed to work at the United Nations and why George Bush lets him go now with such reluctance.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you for being with us, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her book, Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at Robert Gates' confirmation hearing today with two former CIA analysts who work with him at the agency. Charlie Hayden here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. John Bolton is the second high-profile member of Bush's national security team to announce his departure since the elections. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld resigned last month. Bush's nominee to replace him, Robert Gates, faces his confirmation hearings today in the Senate. Gates served as CIA director during the Bush senior administration. He was first nominated to serve under President Reagan, but the nomination had to be withdrawn because of stiff opposition in the Senate. Observers are predicting a swift confirmation with little opposition expected from Democrats, but Gates is not without controversy. Questions have swirled around his involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal and his role in the U.S. government's arming of Saddam Hussein in the 80s. He was also accused of skewing intelligence to suit the Reagan administration's anti-Soviet views. Newly declassified government documents also reveal Gates advocated for President Reagan to bomb Nicaragua in 1984 in an effort to topple the Sandinista government. At the time, Gates was deputy director of the CIA. Well, today we're joined by two former CIA analysts who work with Robert Gates at the agency. Ray McGovern served in the CIA for 27 years and was Gates' branch chief at the CIA in the early 70s. Jennifer Glaudemans is a former CIA analyst who was asked to testify at the 91 confirmation hearings for Gates when he'd been nominated to be CIA director. She worked in the CIA's Office of Soviet Analysis back when Gates was the agency's deputy director for intelligence and chair of the National Intelligence Council. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, and we begin with Jennifer Glaudemans, former CIA analyst, who testified against Robert Gates when he went up for confirmation as CIA chief for the second time. Now, he was—he did not get that post the first time under Reagan. He did get it under President H.W. Bush, George H.W. Bush. But the highest number of senators opposed that nomination than all the senators combined in voting for CIA chiefs over the preceding decades. Jennifer Glaudemans, why did you testify against Robert Gates?
Good morning, Amy. I testified before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence in 1991 because the staff had called me that summer and asked me to come and talk with them about some of the issues I had worked on while I was in the Office of Soviet Analysis, in particular the Third World Activities Division. Prior to Mr. Gates's nomination to be DCI, the staff committee had begun looking into the question of politicization of analysis. They had already talked to a large number of senior and mid-level analysts and managers at the agency. At that point, I had already resigned government and was living in Connecticut. I was called because I had been a witness and a participant in some of the intelligence products that had been politicized. And after talking with them several times over the summer, they flew me down. They paid my expenses. I did not contact them. They asked me to testify. What was clear was that there were a number, I was sort of to represent the analysts, a number of dozens of analysts who had talked to the committee over the summer and early fall of 1991. I first gave my testimony in closed hearing, and after that was done, I believe it was Senator Nunn and insisted that it go public. We were asked to leave, and there was a several-hour meeting within this. Among the senators on the committee, they decided to make it public. And at that point, I was asked, Mrs. Glaudemans, would you like to voluntarily come testify to this committee, or would you like a subpoena? My production folders and records had already been subpoenaed by the staff. And, you know, I do happen to believe that the legislative branch of our government is an equal branch of our government. And when they ask you to inform them about the work you did at taxpayers' expense, of course I volunteered. I did not need a subpoena to talk to my government, but it is not something, and I don't like the perception that I went running to the committee or to anyone else. They had been looking into this prior to me ever talking to them. Thank you.
And Russia, the whole issue of the Soviet Union at the time, specifically this issue of fixing the facts around the policy to fit the policy of the administration, something people are very concerned about today in the lead-up to the invasion, the whole argument put forward of weapons of mass destruction when it turned out not to be the case. How did it play out then?
It was a very tumultuous atmosphere, particularly in the Third World Activities Division, where the Cold War was hot. There were, you know, volatile situations throughout the Middle East, as well as Central America, and a few Africa, even in the question of, you know, remaining Soviet bases in Cameron Bay. So it was throughout the Third World, the Cold War. Ideologues had, that's where the issue was fought out, was how was Soviet behavior going to play out. That's where all of the intelligence arguments and battles were. My problem with that was I love vigorous debate. I had some tremendous mentors in the agency who challenged me all of the time, who made me a better analyst, but it was always about evidence. What happened in the Third World Activities Division was analytical judgments were put out as community view and estimates or a CIA view for which there was no evidence. The Iran estimate in 1985 is just a classic example of that, and one I was personally involved with. There was no evidence to support the key judgment about the Soviets and that Iranian estimate. There was a ton of evidence that contradicted that. So it's not a question of a young junior analyst not getting her view taken. It was a question of evidence versus no evidence.
And Bob Gates's role in that exactly?
He was, as the CIA was the drafter of that segment of the estimate, he was our boss, his deputy director of intelligence, but he was also simultaneously the chairman of the National Intelligence Committee, which put out the estimate. Now, one of the interesting facts, when you go back and look at these allegations, is that the CIA never took a footnote to an estimate, could not dissent to an estimate, as long as Mr. Gates was also the chairman of the NIC. Now, not since he held that position has anyone ever yet again held the conflict of interest position of holding those two jobs. That alone, I think, speaks of what happened. Now, in my division, I don't remember, as maybe I don't remember exactly how many people it was, but, you know, we were colleagues. We worked, we saw each other's work, we saw each other every day. I had bosses fired, some come and go. I mean, it was a tumultuous atmosphere. It was so tumultuous that the Inspector General did an investigation when Webster became our DCI. And long before Gates' second nomination to be DCI, there was an Inspector General investigation. Many analysts, not just myself, many managers, I think everyone in the Office of Soviet Analysis was interviewed. And one of the judgments of that IG report was that the perception of politicization of analysis was pervasive.
We're talking to Jennifer Glaudemans. She's talking about the Times DCI, of course, standing for Director of Central Intelligence, head of the Central Intelligence Agency. Ray McGovern also with us, with the agency for 27 years. When you look at the senators who are in office today that voted against Robert Gates to be head of Central Intelligence for the second time in 1991. Of the 31 senators who voted against, 12 of them are still in the Senate. But I saw Senator Carl Levin interviewed this weekend, who is a key figure here in this decision, who said while he did vote against him in the past, that was 15 years ago. Your response, Ray McGovern.
Well, I'm very distraught to see that the Senate appears willing to acquiesce in a witness or a candidate who was very disingenuous the last time he was called before Congress and before the Iran-Contra affair. It's a very problematic decision. In some ways, the Democrats are facing their first test after the election. They have the power to block this nomination, or at least to investigate Gates to see, to look into the evidence that has come to light since the 1991 confirmation proceedings. And it looks like they're more inclined to give him absolution, so to speak, and say, well, let bygones be bygones. Iran-Contra was a terrible thing, but maybe he's reformed. Daschle, Senator Daschle, back in 91, said we can't afford to take the chance that a fellow who has deliberately trimmed intelligence and taken liberties with the truth will reform. The real question is whether Gates will bring what is called a fresh perspective to policymaking on Iraq, for example. We see in the Post today Robert Burns saying that the president needs to have people who are strong and who will disagree with him. Now, Bobby Gates is not that kind of person. He never has been and he never will be. And so what we have here is just an additional person in this very tightly closed circle around the president, which in intelligence parlance is called a self-licking ice cream cone. What you have here is a slight change in flavor, less tart, more sugary, with the replacement of Bobby Gates for Dick Cheney, but you don't have any real change in policy. The recipe for the ice cream is still being dictated by Bush, and even more so by Cheney. The big question, of course, is whether Cheney has lost influence with the departure of Rumsfeld. The conventional wisdom was, of course, he will have lost that influence. But looking at what the president has been saying about Iraq, and looking at the way they are dissing already the Baker-Hamilton report as just one of the inputs into the situation, suggests to me that Cheney is still very much in control, and that Gates's modus operandi will be to become Cheney's best friend and write memos, as he did for Bill Casey. Bill Casey wanted to wage war in Nicaragua. Bobby Gates would give him reason not only to do the Contra thing, but also to bomb Nicaragua.
Explain that, Ray McGovern, for people, especially young people, who aren't familiar with Iran-Contra and specifically the bombing of the Nicaraguan harbor in 1984. What was Robert Gates' position?
Well, his position was whatever Bill Casey's position was. And that's, you know, that's the real problem here.
Bill Casey, former director of Central Intelligence.
Yes, he was sort of a creation of Bill Casey. Bill Casey had this bizarre notion that the Soviets were going to come up through Nicaragua and Mexico into Texas. Reagan even said such things. And Bobby Gates sort of played on that kind of shibboleth. And when Casey bombed the mined the harbors, well, Gates wrote a memo that said we ought to bomb them as well, bomb the tanks. So, you know, whether he believed that or not, this was a deliberate sort of pandering to the known proclivities of Bill Casey and, of course, the president. And, you know, worse still, when the folks in the White House decided to sell arms to Iran so that some of the profits from that arms sales could be given to the Contras in contravention of U.S. law, when all that happened, Gates was right in the middle of all that, right in the middle. And we have documentary evidence of that now, which has come out since the 91 hearings. And the prospect of our senators not even bothering to look into that evidence, not bothering to honor their constitutional oath to defend the Constitution of the United States, not the president or not the president's nominees, that is really very disappointing.
As do you take this vote, which they're hoping to push through very quickly within a week to confirm Robert Gates, to be a kind of test, a bellwether of what's to come with a democratically controlled Senate and Congress?
I hope not, Amy. You know, there is this one predominant factor, which I call the ABR factor, anybody but Rumsfeld. And Gates is the supreme beneficiary of that factor. They want Rumsfeld out of there. But it's unseemly haste, in my view. There is a report that Gates can't come in until January in any case, because he has obligations still down there in Texas. If that's the case, these senators should do their homework. And if they do their homework, they will see more damaging evidence still of Gates' role in Iran-Contra and in other areas that still have yet to be thoroughly explored.
Ray McGovern and Jennifer Glaudemans, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, two former longtime CIA analysts. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we move on to our last segment, Cuba is coming off the week-long celebration of the 80th birthday of President Fidel Castro. Castro's birthday was in August, but celebrations were delayed when Castro fell ill with an unspecified intestinal condition. He has not appeared in public and did not attend last week's events, as well as this weekend. The Cuban government insists Castro is improving, but there's speculation his condition is worse than has been publicly disclosed. During his absence, Castro has ceded power to his brother Raul. On Friday, Raul Castro attended a celebration at Havana's Karl Marx Theater that was attended by thousands of people. The crowd heard from a number of foreign guests, including Bolivian President Evo Morales.
Un hombre sabio, un compañero inclaudicable, incansable en la lucha antiimperialista.
A sage man, an untiring comrade in the anti-imperialist struggle. To the new generation, he is a teacher, a friend, an older brother, unforgettable. To talk with Fidel is a great lesson, especially for me. I come here to express my respect, my admiration to the comandante, to his people, because to talk at this junction of Castro and of Fidel is to talk about solidarity, of equality, of the anti-imperialist struggle.
Evo Morales, the Bolivian president. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega also spoke.
He is an inspiration. Like José Martí, he's a teacher, the teacher of a generation that was born, fights, and will continue to fight for the example and the ideals of Fidel.
The week's events were capped with a military parade through Havana Saturday. In a rare speech, acting Cuban leader Raul Castro called for negotiations with the United States to resolve its longstanding isolation of the Cuban government. The Bush administration rejected the overture, calling Raul Castro a, quote, dictator in waiting. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by longtime award-winning filmmaker John Alpert, who has spent years in Cuba, as well as his daughter, Tammy, who has also gone on a number of those encounters with Cuban President Fidel Castro. Cuban band leader Arsenio Rodriguez here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and today we're joined by longtime colleague John Alpert in Cuba this past week. His latest trip to the country, he's visited regularly for more than 34 years. John's an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker and the co-founder of Downtown Community Television, which is where we broadcast from as well. Joining us in our Firehouse studio, John's daughter, Tammy Alpert, also just returned from Cuba with her father. She first visited Cuba when she was, well, a year and a half. And we welcome you as well, Tammy and John. So you've just come back. What was this weekend like, the 80th birthday celebration without the birthday boy, Fidel Castro?
I think it was sort of bittersweet. I think that people came from all over the world, and Cubans paid tribute to him. But I think he would have liked to have attended his own party, and everybody would have liked to have seen him, and his absence was really missed.
You talked to the president of the National Assembly, Ricardo Alarcón.
Yeah, we were able to, I think, have the only interview with any top Cuban official during this week. The Cubans basically let the events speak for themselves and let Fidel's absence speak for itself. And we had a very interesting discussion with President Alarcón in which he talked personally about his own feelings, how he discovered that Fidel was ill, and what it means to the country.
Let's play a clip of that interview.
If you can talk a little bit personally, when Fidel became sick. What were your first thoughts? How did you react to that? And how do you react to almost sort of the bittersweet, you know, people are paying tribute to Fidel, but we also realize that he's human and that the clock ticks for everybody.
Well, let me tell you this. I learned that directly from him. I didn't hear anything before. It was a...
What did he tell you?
I got a phone call by him. Mm-hmm. And it was a very short conversation by phone. Mm-hmm. He asked me, can you come here? For how do it will take to you to come here? Right. And he said, well, he calculated it was 5-10 minutes ago. Okay, yeah. I see you. That was my phone.
Right.
When I arrived, I saw him lying on a bed with some...
medical things attached to him, yeah.
Yeah, this sort of thing that the hospitals use. And then he explained to me what happened. That was after, that was why, how I learned that he had gone through surgery the day before.
Oh, so he called you after the operation?
Yeah, uh-huh. Of course. He described, you know, how mm-hmm. how is he? He knew everything and he gave some details about the what happened. Mm-hmm. In a way, of course, that raised a concern because you some sad feelings because you see a friend suffering mm-hmm. or having gone through a very risky situation. But on the other hand, was he himself personally, live, direct, mm-hmm. explaining to me what happened? And obviously he was very alert, very, mm-hmm. Very alive. Mm-hmm. And we even made jokes. But,
like what?
For example, I mm-hmm. told him, do you imagine what will happen in the world tomorrow? Because we talk about the announcement he was going to make that night.
Right.
And I was right. From that moment, all the media around the world turned to that story, Fidel's operation and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And we laugh, both, trying to figure out what was going to be the impact of this news. And we were right, it was.
Cuban National Assembly President Ricardo Alarcón speaking to documentary filmmaker John Alpert. In this next clip, John asked Alarcón to talk about Castro and the Cuban government, how it's adapted to Castro's illness.
One clear modification is that he continues being the leader of the revolution, but not assuming or performing that leadership in the manner you were accustomed to see him doing things, moving around, and so on. Now, he is following things, giving directive, giving his views, his opinion, taking decisions, but not by performing him personally the most apparent role and not being in a more discreet fashion. You don't see him, but he is very much mm-hmm. involved in things that are going on. And other comrades are the ones that are moving around, spending hours handling the issues and reporting to him. He will give his... In other words, what Fidel is doing now is more akin to the style that most leaders use. Most leaders for the entire tenure mm-hmm. of office have been working that way and not the Fidel's way. Fidel has to adjust to that.
So he has to delegate a little bit more than he did before. Is he a little bit bittersweet? Is he sorry that he can't celebrate this birthday in the way that I'm sure he would have liked to have celebrated it? Has he told you he's frustrated about that?
No, I am sure that he is. Mm-hmm. He even said in the message he sent to the participants in his celebration that he's sad that he couldn't be there and salute them personally and so on. It's different to imagine Fidel being forced to do that, and I am sure that he's especially sad for him.
Does he listen to his doctors? Does he mind them, or does he have his own ideas?
Probably he has his own ideas, but he has to obey the doctors. Uh-huh.
Cuban National Assembly President Alarcón, speaking in Havana this weekend with documentary filmmaker John Alpert in our studio. John, you have been interviewing Fidel Castro over the decades a number of times. In fact, you flew with him from Cuba to New York.
Yeah, we were the only reporters that went with him when he came to the United Nations to address them in 1979. And I had seen him so many times before, I was always wondering, even when he went to the bathroom, he had bodyguards with him, and I wanted him to explain what type of life that was like. And I also wanted to know if he was wearing his bulletproof vest, and so I asked him. Let's take a look.
I'll never forget when I saw you in the Moncada.
Por ejemplo, nunca olvidaré cuando lo vi en el Moncada.
You had to go to the bathroom.
Usted tuvo que ir al baño.
But you had to go with three other people.
Pero tuvo que ir con otras tres personas.
And you're always wearing your bulletproof vest.
Siempre está protegido con su traje.
¿Cuál traje?
What suit?
Everybody says you always have a
vest. Sé que todo el mundo dice que usted tiene un chaleco a prueba de balas.
No. Voy a desembarcar así en Nueva York.
I will land in New York like this.
Tengo un chaleco.
I will land in New York like this.
Tengo un chaleco moral.
I have a moral one.
A moral vest.
A moral vest.
Es fuerte.
It's strong.
Ese me ha protegido siempre.
That one has protected me always.
Hace demasiado calor en Cuba para tener un chaleco.
It's too hot in Cuba to have a bulletproof vest.
Yo estuve en Nueva York.
I was in New York.
En el año... Yo creo que fue en el año 49, ¿no?
In 1949, I think.
49 o 48.
49 or 48.
Estaba de luna de miel en Nueva York.
I was on a honeymoon in New York.
Which wife?
¿Qué esposa?
¿Eh?
¿Cuál es la esposa?
Una mujer.
A woman.
Eso no tiene importancia
that
especial.
That is unimportant.
Es la historia mía.
It's my history.
Entonces estaba de luna de miel.
So then I was on a honeymoon.
Entonces estuve en Nueva York como tres semanas.
So I was in New York for about 3 or 4 weeks.
Hacía frío.
It was cold.
Entonces cocinaba.
And then I cooked.
Iba a un delicatessen.
I used to go to a delicatessen.
A un Minimax.
To a Minimax.
Paseaba por Nueva York.
I used to travel around New York.
Estuve en la universidad de Boston.
University of Boston.
Harvard.
At Harvard.
En esa época estaba pensando estudiar en Harvard.
At that time I was planning to study at Harvard.
Sabe estudiar economía.
I was planning to study economics.
Y entonces estuve como 3 o 4
then,
semanas en Nueva York.
I was in New York for about 3 or 4 weeks.
155 West 82nd Street. Y entonces pagaba mi alquiler
and
muy modesto.
I used to pay my rent a very modest.
En esa
rent.
Época el dólar valía algo.
At that time the dollar was worth something.
Y con pocos dólares.
And with very few dollars.
Se podía pagar la casa.
One could pay for rent.
Se podía comprar en la tienda.
One could buy in the stores.
Y se podía cocinar.
And one could cook.
Visité algunos lugares.
I visited a few places in the city.
En fin, no la pasé mal. La pasé
so
mal.
It was not a bad time. It was all right.
No tenía mucho dinero.
I did not have a lot of money.
Pero la vida no era muy cara.
But life was not very expensive.
En aquella época.
Then.
Después sí.
Then things changed.
Ahora sería imposible
now
que yo hiciera esa misma cosa.
Now it would be impossible for me to do these
porque
same things.
Sigo igual.
Because I'm still the same.
No tengo dinero.
I have no money.
Y el dólar está devaluado.
And the dollar is devalued.
La vida está muy cara.
Life is very expensive.
Entonces voy a parar en la misión cubana.
So then I will be staying at the Cuban mission.
No tengo que pagar alquiler.
I do not have to pay rent.
Porque es propiedad del Estado
because
cubano.
It is owned by the Cuban state.
Así que voy a gastar menos dinero en Nueva York de lo que gasté en 1948.
Cuban President Fidel Castro being interviewed by John Alpert in 1979 aboard a plane from Havana to New York to give an address at the UN. And you went with him to the place where he would then sleep that he was describing.
We stayed with Fidel for a whole week. We ate with him. We filmed all his meetings. We have one of the most extensive collections of behind the scenes of Fidel. I don't think anybody else has anything like this. You know, we even went to bed with Fidel. You know, he took us into his bedroom. I mean, this tape's amazing.
And how do you like sleeping in New York?
¿Y qué tal le parece dormir en Nueva York?
Excelente.
Excellent.
Nueva York es un lugar excelente para dormir.
New York is an excellent place to sleep.
No, it's noisy.
No, hace mucho ruido.
Yo había oído decir que había mucha polución.
I heard that there was a lot of pollution.
Pero a pesar de todo, he dormido espléndidamente.
But despite all that, I've slept splendidly well.
Mm-hmm. Did you think about your speech at all last night while you were lying here?
Anoche cuando estaba acostado aquí, pensó en su discurso.
No, quise pensar en eso.
No, I didn't want to think about that.
Eso lo dejo para dentro de una hora que tengo que hablar.
I'll leave that for an hour's time. That's when I'll have to speak.
Fidel Castro in his bed at the Cuban mission in New York in 1979, just hours before his General Assembly address. Well, this is some of what he had to say just about an hour or two later when he took the podium at the UN.
I have not come here as a prophet of the revolution. I have come to speak of peace and cooperation among the peoples. Human rights are very often spoken of, but we must also speak of humanity's rights. Why should some people go barefoot that others may travel in expensive cars? I speak on behalf of the children of the world who don't even have a piece of bread.
Yes, that was Cuban President Fidel Castro at the United Nations in 1979. And you continued to interview him, John, when President George H.W. Bush was president, too, in 1992. You asked him about the president.
The terrible Bush administration was bad for the U.S. and bad for the world. Nothing could be worse than Bush.
That was Fidel Castro talking about Bush Sr. Tammy Alpert, you were with your dad then in 1992. How old were you?
I was a freshman in high school at the time. And we actually, our interview was pushed back about a week, so I was missing a little bit of school. So at the end of the interview, Fidel Castro was nice enough to write me an excuse letter.
You brought that excuse letter with you?
I did bring a copy of the excuse letter. Yeah. And here's a piece of the footage showing him writing this letter to me.
What's your teacher's name, Tom?
Here he is writing me a letter, and for those of you on the radio, I'm spelling out the name of my teacher right now for Vidal to spell out my excuse note.
Maestro.
How do you spell Mr. Krensky's
name?
K-R-K-R-I.
Here he is writing me a letter, and he's asking me the spelling of my teacher's name.
Okay. Fidel was having a little trouble. He was speaking English pretty well, but he hasn't had much practice, and he was apologizing. But this was a pretty good excuse note.
So you didn't get in trouble, presumably, Tammy, for coming late to school.
Please excuse Tammy from her absence.
And now, holding that today. Tammy, what was it like to go to Cuba this weekend?
Well, I've been going back ever since I was about a year and a half old. And on this past weekend, we had a chance to meet a lot of the people that we've seen in the past, and we tracked down a lot of the same folks. It's a good barometer to see what's happening in Cuba, because every time we go meet with real people, and we get to see what's happening in their lives. And so on this trip, we actually were very lucky. We met some of the same people that we found on past trips.
We only have 10 seconds, but the experience of the people on the ground in Cuba of Fidel Castro now no longer being very visible.
You know, Cuba, the daily life is the same. But for people that know Fidel and who have watched what he's done, I mean, there's a sad feeling because the clock ticks for everybody. It ticks for Fidel, and he might have done amazing things, but he's human.
John and Tommy Alpert, thanks so much for being with us. Tonight I'll be in Hewlett, New York, then in Harrisonburg, Virginia this weekend on Friday night. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fogo Caduce. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.